get into the weeds of all of these cultural questions and really start to reform institutions in what is quite a heavy-handed way, a sort of centralized way. It's still democratic and it's still, you know, it's respecting people's individual rights. And it's not going against the law, but it is saying we don't trust the institutions to be neutral.
Essentially, I think me and Carl have been also curious as to ask sort of what made you snap, or how did you change your mind?
Den unge mand, han revolutionær.
The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
How dare you?
It's great to have you on, Eric. I have to show you. I bought your book back in 18.
Oh, fantastic.
It's a really thick and heavy book. And I think you were one of the first people who sort of articulated in this sort of, I'd call it mainstream sense, but also very like meticulously drawn from the demographic trends. And that's the thing I think has been lacking from the discourse. It's always been like people trying to interpret sort of populist wave. And basically, if you're a populist, you have a take. And if you're an anti-populist, you have a take. But your, I think, case was fascinating when it came out. And it's even more sort of relevant today, I think. So it's great to have you on.
Well, thanks very much, Carl. Perfect.
Okay, well, let's just kick it off then. One of the things we're trying to figure out with the podcast and our conversations is how to develop new political ideas in a country such as Sweden. And obviously, being a student of political sciences and perhaps populism in particular, what we think of here is the rise of a new kind of populist party or vector in Sweden. And while this can be said to be present throughout all the Western world, what's interesting about Sweden is that you've had this quite overt progressive political agenda that most of the political parties have sort of like wholesale tapped into. Then you have even a lack of a self-understanding of how we can have other political interests in Sweden, of which the Sweden Democrats would be the main vessel for. But now, in a way, it's endemic to all of the Western world. But so for that reason alone, I think it's relevant for us also to get you on, because somehow it feels like as Swedes, we don't really see the forest behind all the trees.
Right.
But also, I mean, going to you as a person, I mean, you yourself, if we borrow from the dichotomy of anywheres and somewheres, are very much an anywhere yourself, born in Hong Kong, citizen of Canada. I think between your mother and fathers, there's a fluency in 20 languages. So polyglot, to say the least.
Yeah, not me, but them. Yeah. But of course, if you look, obviously, historically, you know, a lot of people who have developed national ideas or nationalist ideas have been people either in the borderland areas or sometimes from mixed backgrounds or, you know, many examples one could go through. I mean, Eamon de Valera, for example, in Ireland, half Spanish, lived in the United States. Partly that's about when you grow up abroad, you become more aware of nationality because you are. My dad was in the Canadian embassy in the Far East. And, you know, nation is not taken for granted the same way it is if you grow up inside a country. So you have to think about it at an earlier stage. So I think that's definitely one of the reasons we see this pattern in history. So I think that partly explains that.
As a Swede, that's very fascinating because I think we have been one of the most homogeneous societies throughout the 20th centuries. And also, like, I think we settled the sort of national identity discussion way back in the distant past. So hence, I think it's fascinating for me because the modern project in Sweden is also a project that sort of only included ethnical Swedes, and the country was very homogeneous. So when we break into the 21st century, we have this huge immigration that sort of goes on from the 80s. And I think this is one of the paradoxes that's sort of hard to break in Sweden, because as a very homogeneous society, we don't have the sort of ideas of nationality, and we've sort of forgotten them because we did not have any participation in the wars for 200 years. So I think here we have like a hotbed of understanding of the sort of processes that you are so good at explaining. And I think I would like your take on where you can see the difference between sort of the Anglosphere and Europe in that sense.
I'm always generally of the view that the Anglosphere is less different from Europe. And in fact, the New World is less different from the Old World than many people presume. So, for example, both the U.S., well, U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand all had quite overwhelming ethnic majorities, which now the difference there is, of course, they were maybe had some contact with difference. And so they were much more self-consciously trying to preserve something. So, for example, the U.S. immigration policy had fixed quotas based on the share of the American population that already existed from about the 1920s to the 1960s. Or you had in Canada, they were in Canada and Australia, they were always trying to make sure the immigration was as British as possible. And they kept certain groups excluded entirely. But the point is that the whole society was envisioned around an ethnic majority the same way it was in Europe. And so when you start to get this liberalization occurring, it's the same debate, really. It's all about, oh, you're a racist if you want to conserve a particular ethnic configuration, or if you want to make distinctions amongst different types of immigrants, or even if you want to slow down the immigration flow. So I actually think it's pretty similar. And in Sweden, for example, you know, if I'm from Canada, and I would say that, you know, this whole rush towards a very kind of culturally, what I would call the cultural left, a very progressive, you know, multiculturalism, let's be super sensitive to minority feelings, let's not talk about immigration because that's not very sensitive. All of that discourse is the same. And the difference, I suppose, is that in Sweden, it's sort of because of the migrant crisis, I think that's helped to break the spell of this taboo a little bit. It's helped to open up the debate a little bit. That hasn't yet occurred in Canada. It's maybe just starting to happen. But and you see this in Ireland as well, where there also has been no real debate. And now some of these stresses out of that is going to be born probably something that happened, you know, with the Sweden Democrats, the AFD. I see it as very much very similar sets of processes.
I mean, you have studied the Irish situation quite extensively. And I'm thinking here primarily of your book, Shall the Religious Inherit the Earth? And I mean, of course, you grapple with more phenomena there, but basically going into the nitty gritty of the conflict between Protestants and Catholics. But we're curious in a way of what you described there, if I'm not mistaken, is a desecularization. That is, we've taken for granted that the general trajectory culture-wise in the West is towards more secularism. But if we understand it correctly, what you see is a sort of return of an enchanted worldview or group identity with regards to creeds. Could you speak to that matter?
Well, yeah, there's two separate phases. So I did the books on Northern Ireland, and then I did the book on religion and demography, and they're somewhat different, actually. So the Northern Ireland is, you have two ethnic groups, one which is Irish Catholic, the other which is sort of, we'll call it British Protestant, but they're actually quite distinct from mainland Britain. They're kind of an Ulster Protestant group. Yes. Their origins are with Scottish and British settlers into Northern Ireland. And so what's interesting there, what I find interesting, it's not really about religion as it was in the 1600s or even the 1700s. It's much more now about tribe, with religion as just a marker. I mean, religion.
You mean they're not Jacobites anymore?
It's really about, you know, orange and green. It's about like, which colors you wear. And it's not now the level of religion is higher than in mainland Britain, but it's not massively higher. But what's interesting there, I suppose, for me, is that it's an exception in many ways to what's happening in the Anglosphere and in the West. So you have history still lives in the minds and hearts of the average citizen much more than it does in mainland Britain. So you have commemorations that occur several times a year. You have popular histories that are written. You have mass associations. The Orange Order, which is the one I studied on the Protestant side, every lodge has, you know, they first of all, there's communications from the center down to the lodges. They do these reenactments. They have histories about, so they know the local battle events. And so you have this more of this sense of the past living in the present much more than in other parts of the West or in many parts of the West. And also you have this kind of almost a rebel history. So just regardless of what's being taught in the schools, you have this popular history and popular memory that is reproduced outside the state. And so that shows you a way in which you can resist, perhaps. I mean, if the state is becoming, if all history is becoming woke in schools and they just want to teach about how colonialist your society was, this provides a counter to that. And so, yeah, I just thought that was quite interesting. Now, the other thing, of course, is that these Catholic Protestant struggles also occurred in North America. So in Canada, for example, the Orange Order, nobody knows this because this is memory hold in Canadian schools, but, you know, Canada's first prime minister, I think four prime ministers were members of the Orange Order. They were every mayor of the city of Toronto from the 1870s to the 1950s, provincial premiers, you know, all of this history was completely hidden. And so that's sort of what got me interested in this in the first place.
Because if I remember correctly, Ontario was like the Boston in the sense of Boston being the hotbed of Irish republicanism, sending funds over to Ireland. Ontario had that same sort of function for the Orangist side or for the Loyalist side. Is that correct?
Well, that sort of. I mean, the Orange tradition in Ontario became more indigenized. So it became, you know, you had, you know, it's not just Irish Protestants, but you had Scottish, you know, American Loyalists. You had even German and others who were members. So it was kind of a more sort of, it changed shape when it went into Canada, but it was very pro-British, Britannic and empire, and all of that was very important to it. And so, yeah, to be in the police, to be in the mayor, to be on the Toronto Transit Authority, all of these jobs were for the boys who were in the, so that kind of setup, the way the Irish Catholics ran Boston is the same way Toronto was run. And so, yeah, that's interesting, you know, and nobody knows this in Canada. It's totally, you know, they don't want to know this, perhaps, or it's just something that nobody's interested in because that's the bad old British Protestant past, and we're trying to be multicultural. And so that's, you know, so that is kind of just shows you how these different parts, very important parts of history, can be completely airbrushed away because they don't fit with anything that the country is trying to promote right now.
Speaking of how it doesn't fit, I think my closest reference to what you're describing is from The Wire, where the police force is essentially Irish culture in their drinking habits and how they think of themselves as the boys.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because the Irish Catholics in the East Coast cities of the U.S. were, you know, they were kind of an immigrant group. They were second class in the 19th century. And then as you start to get into the 20th century, they've worked their way up the police force. Then they become the mayors. And then eventually they kind of become a dominant group themselves. You know, like Boston, they become a dominant group. And then the whole thing, it gets inverted. And so somehow, you know, things like the St. Patrick's Day Parade and these other sort of symbols of Irishness somehow now are starting to be associated with whiteness and with the establishment. And so you've seen this whole thing invert, which is really interesting.
But I think that's the sort of common theme I think we have everywhere. You've written several books on the topic from different factors, but tribe is really a thing that is emerging now out of sort of the shattering of the sort of modernist consensus. Because now we have the sort of contrast in countries like Sweden. It might be a poor choice of words, but I think everyone understands, because where culture was once homogenous, we now have a very different demography, but also we have a split between, I think, traditionalist people who sort of want to embrace tradition, and also people who are radically, one could call them woke, for lack of a better term, cultural revolutionist, basically. And this is a thing we see all over the Western world. So hence, tribe is becoming something important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think it ever was unimportant. But of course, the more the demography shifts, the more people are aware that this is something that they're losing. And then you get a defensive reaction. It's a bit like the, you know, to some degree, the decline of the Irish and Welsh languages was the beginning of Irish and Welsh nationalism. Yeah. And I think so maybe we're seeing something like that here. And then, of course, if you go through American history, when you started to see the significant shifting demographically, and this was with the Irish Catholics coming in certain East Coast cities, that was the first wave where you saw what's known as the Know-Nothing or the American Party.
Sorry, can you unpack that?
Well, this is the most successful third party in American history, called the and they were called the American Party. So you started to get very large-scale Irish Catholic immigration after the famine in Ireland in the 1850s, to the point that the Irish became the majority or close to the majority in Boston and a couple of East Coast cities. Mm. And so what you had was this Protestant backlash. Of course, the U.S. was, you know, the free population was 98% Protestant at the time, of basically almost entirely Protestant, like 98, something like that, up until the 1850s. And then you started to see this change. And then as a reaction to that change, you suddenly had anti-Catholicism and you had this American Party, which I think it got about a quarter of the vote, which in a two-party system with, you know, that's quite something and has never even been touched since. I'm trying to remember what Ross Perot, but any that was in a primary. That wasn't actually in an election. This is in a federal election. And if it wasn't for the Civil War, people said that if it wasn't for the issue of slavery in the Civil War, which split the Know-Nothing movement into its southern and northern components, they would have won the presidency. So this is a sort of hugely important phenomenon in American history. Now, I could then... You had the Civil War and you had the Irish Catholic immigration sort of went down after that because Ireland wasn't that large a place. But you then get into the 1890s and the same forces are coming again because you're starting to get more Catholic immigration. This time, sort of especially as we get into the late 1890s, coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, Italy, Poland, these places. And the Anglo-Protestant share was coming towards 50% around 1920. And then you had the same what's called nativism, what we would call kind of immigration restrictionist popular anti-Catholic populist movements spring up and enact a whole series of restrictionist immigration laws, culminating in the 1924 law, which says, well, we're going to have an immigration flow that matches the ethnic composition of the existing population. And every country has a quota and they're not allowed to. So the quota for Italy was really small compared to the number of people who wanted to come. And so they instituted these quotas and that lasted until the liberalization of the mid-1960s in something called the Hart-Celler Act of 1965. Now, there was a slight liberalization in the 50s, but largely resisted. And so this 60s really represents a shift. By the way, in the 60s, Canada and Australia also relaxed their kind of more, if you like, ethnic quotas, and it became much more of a kind of ostensibly colorblind system. And that's when we get the big demographic shifts. Of course, in Europe, it's something different. Europe used to always send people, and then Europe became a net importer of people. And then so Europe's change happens also maybe a little later in Sweden than it does in some other countries like Britain. But it's all kind of happening around the same time.
I think that's interesting because I think the only cultural memory of that I can sort of grasp for is basically Gangs of New York, where you have that sort of split very visible between Daniel Day-Lewis's character, who's nativist, and the Roman Catholics. It's interesting because I think, as you said, a lot of things have been memory hold. And Sweden is one of the countries that had immigration restrictions for, I think, the longest time. And in our case, ostensibly in defense of what we call the Swedish system, which was a corporativist system that sort of fused labor and capital and sort of had these restrictions of immigrations to keep wages for working people high. And this was the stated goal of the Social Democrat Party for a very, very long time until basically the 90s. But I think as this sort of modernist consensus sort of collapses now into only tribal politics, where we see a sort of the discussion of this is only in a sort of framework of racist versus anti-racist, and either you sort of discuss this sort of as a question of justice, not as policy or as anything else. And I would like to maybe if we could chart that sort of change, where sort of race becomes this issue. Is it a question, do you think, of demography of the white sort of group becoming more less than, of course, you mean you go from 98% to in the US of having this sort of Protestant identity until now, where we see places like California and I think Arizona, there is a white minority.
Yeah.
And just to clarify, I think Carl's question in a way is also a way to segue over to your most recent book that's coming out next year, Taboo, where race becomes this taboo topic. So it fits quite neatly into the demographic changes you just described, into the cultural shift from, like, say, mid-1900s onwards.
So that is a really interesting question that, and I think this is why we need to look at the shifts that are occurring within liberalism and within the left. You know, you mentioned the corporatist system in Sweden. You know, in the case of, let's take the United States, the unions were at the forefront of immigration restriction. The American Federation of Labor, the Knights of Labor, all of these groups going back the 19th century and the 20th century were the strongest voices for restriction because they wanted to keep wages high. And it was always a coalition between the unions and the patriotic societies and some conservative intellectuals. That was kind of the coalition that was at the forefront of restriction. And they had populist support as well from a large, particularly the rural mass of the population. And the U.S. was predominantly a rural country up until 1920 majority. And so what occurs by the time we get into the sort of, it's really as late as the 60s that the shift in the mentality of the union leadership. And what's occurring is that the intellectual left coming out of the universities, coming out of the left-wing elite cultural publications takes over, increasingly starts to take over some of these institutions at the top, or the leadership will be marinated in some of these new ideas. Maybe it was Fabianism in Britain, although there's some interesting overlaps between Fabianism and eugenics. So even like something like and in Canada, you know, the major left-wing party, the ancestor of the New Democratic Party, you know, some of the people who were important in that party were very staunch immigration restrictionists. We have to explain this shift on the left away. And in fact, the Marxist left believed that allowing in people from less developed, less advanced societies would make it harder to have socialist revolution. And so the orthodoxy on the Marxist left was also immigration restrictionist. Not always, not uniformly, but generally. And certainly in the case of the US, what changes is you start to get a shift on the left starting in the at the very beginning in the 1910s, like in the United States in particular, liberal progressivism comes in. And that's a different type of left, but it's the liberal left. That becomes the dominant strain. And one of their arguments as we get into the 1930s, 40s, 50s, you know, they're making arguments around the U.S. should be a melting pot, a plural society, et cetera. Now, that's only the view of a minority of the population. Harry Truman and the Democrats, when they're trying to open up immigration in the 50s, they're talking about, oh, the Bible says there should be neither Jew nor Greek, and the American Constitution is about we're a city on a hill and a beacon to the world. All these sorts of universalist ideas. That's sort of the way they thought about it. But there wasn't this kind of anti-racist sting as much. Yes, there were people saying, my Jewish and Italian friend are as good an American as you, Puritan, and whatever. So you have some of that kind of moralistic language. But doesn't seem to be taken as seriously until we get the sort of race taboo coming in mid-1960s with the civil rights movement, the end of Jim Crow segregation in the South. And suddenly you have this story that just seems to suddenly capture the imagination. And overnight, you get this sudden change. You know, there's a story Paul Krugman in the New York Times says, you know, everybody in Long Island, they repainted their black coachmen on their front gates white instead of black. And all of a sudden, you know, and Shelby Steele also talks about it, that the whole society was delegitimated overnight almost. And yeah, I think we're living through that revolution, the rise of that taboo. And then it infects everything. It starts to infect immigration. That's racist to talk about immigration. Of course, the other thing, of course, the immigration flow had shifted away from Southern and Eastern Europe, not totally, but more towards Latin America, Asia, et cetera. And so it was more of a racial thing, a racial difference, which mapped onto that new race taboo. And then by the time we get to Europe, it's the same sorts of... Now, I'd say in Europe, like Britain, the popular race taboo did not come into place until the mid-70s or 80s. So, well, much later than the American race taboo, which became more widespread earlier. However, at the elite levels, you can already see in the writings of British elites when they were discussing the Commonwealth Immigration Act to cut off access for the whole British Empire to Britain, those sorts of anti-racist discourses were already important in the early 1960s. And so this taboo, it just seems to have arisen in several places at once. And until we actually find a way of unpicking it, making it more of a proportional thing rather than a tripwire, then I just don't think we're going to be able to get out of these questions.
And that is something that we should return to, basically, what are the antidotes going forward. But I wanted to get back to what you mentioned. I was like, almost overnight you have the shift, because I can see this like change from, as you said, first from the US, you have change in policies, and then in the UK, and perhaps further down the road, you get to somewhere in mainland Europe or Sweden. But this anecdote of overnight changing the stance with regards to race or ethnicity, that's the kind of thing you would find in a country like Sweden, where you have room for one general opinion at a time. So it's could you unpack as to, I mean, how do you, are we talking about a sort of what is the word I'm looking for? Cumulative change that then brings about a qualitative shift. Like, how can we understand these kind of, do we find these kind of changes in other areas of policy, or is it particularly with regards to ethnicity or race?
Well, there is a certain literature on taboos and deviance, you know, so the taboo over being gay or sex before marriage, or, you know, some of these things have declined. Taboos rise up and then they fall away. And it's interesting to see how that happens. The way it happens is people just make an accusation like, you're a racist. And if that isn't resisted in some effective way, that becomes where the taboo moves to. So if they say, yeah, reducing immigration is racist, and nobody makes an argument against that, then suddenly that's the new taboo. Now, if somebody comes along and says, no, it's not racist. In fact, it's vital to, for a whole bunch of reasons, and you're not listening to the people, and we're just going to do it. I mean, to some degree, for example, the rise of the Sweden Democrats or the AFD has helped to not entirely break the taboos, but it's helped to push some of these taboos back a little bit. Or the case of the U.S., Donald Trump's takeover of the Republican Party on the basis of making the border a key issue for him has helped to break taboos against discussing immigration within the Republican Party. So on the right of the spectrum in the U.S., that taboo has actually been pushed back. So there's this whole game of declarative speech acts and resisting those speech acts, and taboos can ebb and flow over time. As we saw with, you know, the taboo against homosexuality or something, I mean, that has sort of, or sex before marriage, that's kind of changed. Whereas the other taboos around racism have expanded. If you look at the rise of the, if you look at public opinion surveys in the U.S. from the 1940s until the 1960s, you can slowly see public opinion becoming more non-racist. So, you know, yes, blacks shouldn't have to sit at the back of the bus in streetcars, or, in terms of they should have an equal chance at a job. You know, these are sort of like in 1944, probably the U.S. public was split 50-50 as to whether a black person should be treated equally in terms of accessing a job. So, but then over time, by the 50s, you know, some of these nursery rhymes that were racist, you know, catch a tigger by his toe was catch a nigger by his toe. That sort of shifting slowly starting to happen in the 50s. And so you kind of, I think, hit this tipping point where, yeah, that quantitative softening of attitudes just then suddenly leads to this sacralization of race. Race becomes sacred, and suddenly there's a flip. And now in 1965, a report on the Black family, which was just, you know, they were getting out of wedlock birth rates of 25%. Now that's nothing. That's the whites have got more than that. But back at the time, that was quite revolutionary. And the report was saying, you know, this could be quite a big issue for the Black community. Of course, it's been a massive issue. He was absolutely right. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Democratic Party senator, the report was labeled racist. You know, it was basically shelved. That's the first time we see this taboo now starting to encroach into what we might call reason, and starting to shut out more and more and more areas of life as being beyond the pale of debate.
One more question. Sorry, Kalle, I want to know what you want to come in, but one more question on who the taboo affects. Because if you look at someone like the Sweden Democrats, it's only really when they get into parliament, into power, where you see start to see the real allergic reaction from other parts of the state, from media, from how politicians debate this. I mean, the reference to basically you could, the references to the 1930s are by now on an almost like, if not every day, like a weekly basis. On the one hand, in the general populace, I think I follow your reasoning that a greater ability to talk about these issues, but within the intelligentsia or the circles where you move, I would say that that's primarily where the space for these issues have become more taboo or contentious. And the corollary to that in the US context would be that it's only with the Trump presidency that while he, of course, might have mobilized part of the Republican Party, it's also with regards to the allergic reaction from the rest of civil society, the state, it's the political opponents. If Trump is against COVID restrictions, they are for COVID restrictions. So the issue transmutes into different ones. And you mentioned this children's song, Catch a Tiger by Its Tail or Toe.
Toe, yeah.
And where the original was Catch a Nigger by Its Toe. In Sweden, you would have cultural productions or movies where you could make fun of the tension with regards to ethnicity or race, most famously in the children's movie Sunes Sommar, where the father of the family, Sunes' father, is trying to get coffee, and then a whole basketball team from the US catches him red-handed stealing the coffee. And of course, these basketball players are African-Americans. And they say, oh, and what do you call these? They point at chocolate balls. And of course, in Sweden, at the time, they were called nigger balls. So he tries to say, well, they're called Nigni. No, they're called the...
Well, take it easy. All we want is coffee.
Yeah, take it.
And I'll have one of those.
Oh, yes.
By the way, what do you call those?
We call them No. We call them Wienerbröd. Wienerbrods.
Oh, no, you don't.
And this is a 1995 movie, I think.
Yeah. You know, the Europe is a bit later on a lot of these taboos, you know, and you can see this whole debate over the Black Pete thing in Netherlands, for example.
Yeah.
But also in Britain, you know, even up until the 1980s, you would get, you know, racist taunts at Black players on the field and bananas thrown at them. You know, this would be unimaginable in the U.S. in the 1980s. That's not to say there was no racism. There was racism in certain areas of the U.S. But I think this taboo starts in America and then works its way over to Europe later. And of course, they didn't have the internet. You still had more of a delay between when things started in the U.S. and when they show up in Europe. So, but now, of course, it's almost synchronous, you know, almost there's almost no delay at all. What I would say, of course, is I also think that I don't think there's a big change recently. I would say that, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s in Canada, you couldn't discuss immigration either. You were already that was off limits. You couldn't talk about ethnic change. That was off limits already. And we had, of course, the first wave of political correctness. And so all of, you know, then it was mainly about, you know, feminism, homophobia, you know, sexism, homophobia, racism, the big three. Now we've got transphobia thrown in. And there have been some innovations, but it's largely the same set of ideas. It's just that the volume maybe has been turned up a little bit. But still, I think you have to go further back before you start to see life before these taboos. And so now these taboos are infiltrating every corner of human life, to the point that, you know, going hiking, going skiing, the countryside, all of these are racist now. And so it's just the working out of that logic, which starts, however, with that hypersensitivity and multiculturalism of even the 70s, really, 70s and 80s. So I trace these things much further back. I think we're going to have to unpick the entire package in order to sort of arrive at something sane. Mm. I mean, you talk about the fascist scare, you know. Mm. So there's this term called Red Scare, yeah, sometimes used in the U.S. McCarthyism was one instance where you know, everybody's a communist. There's a communist hiding behind every stone. There have been those periods in, like, U.S. history. One was in the 1920s. One was in the 50s. But I think we've kind of been living through this fascist scare for a much longer period of time, and it's been pretty continuous. Mm. That all you have to do is say, oh, fascist hiding behind that couch, and everybody immediately, their mind goes to 1933 and marching with Nazi symbols. Mm. You know, and in the case of the U.S., you could see that already, you know, in the late 30s, when you really did have a fascist threat, some of the anti-fascist liberal intellectuals went too far and started accusing people who were just American nationalists of being fascists. And that continued a bit after the war. But it never had the same power. It had a certain amount of power, but it wasn't able to carry everything before it the way these accusations do now, where they control all these institutions. Because that's the other part of it, is that this sort of the people who I would call cultural socialists, they now control all the institutions, and they set the tone in these institutions. Whereas in the past, these institutions actually, they reflected a mix of other influences that are sort of remnants from a further period in the past. So they weren't completely, the tone, the institutional culture was not so totally saturated with these kind of left modernist, you know, i.e. cultural socialism plus liberal modernism. That's now the orthodoxy in all these institutions, and including the school system, including the university system, the media. Mm. And this is why they're having such reactions, these disgust reactions. You get a disgust reaction when there's a violation of a taboo. If I started going to the toilet at the dinner table at a nice restaurant, you know, you'd have this reaction. Mm. Because these are social taboos that have been woven into what's called the social construction of reality, you know, everyday reality. You're supposed to shake a hand this way. You're supposed to kind of embrace a woman this way. You're supposed to not go to the blow your nose on the tablecloth. What's happening here is it's the same thing, this taboo around racism, which has become highly, highly ultra sensitive. Any violation leads to the same reaction you'd have as if someone blew their nose in the tablecloth. Mm. And that's, I think, explaining the kinds of things you're talking about.
I think it's really interesting that it's almost beyond, like, cognition. It's more to do with, like, a visceral reaction. Kalle, I come to think of your favorite book, Road to Wigan Pier.
Orwell's.
Yeah, you know the quote, yeah. The quote I'm thinking about?
You go ahead.
The problem with the working class is that they smell.
Yeah.
All right.
and that's the sort of social taboo we have now. And that's sort of very finely ties in with both your points, which is sort of the politics we have now is one of basically disgust for, I mean, Sweden is very, very literally like this, because Sweden Democrats are a party basically of what people here in Stockholm think of as peasants, and they do smell, and hence there's sort of a class aspect to it as well, because if you want to be let into polite society, you don't blow your nose on tablecloth. You do not speak of certain subjects. Hence, if you live in a sort of highly developed service economy, this is a problem, because everyone who's sort of sensible enough to obey taboos will sort of be indoctrinated by this view of the world and of politics. Hence, why you only get the sort of a populist response to this, which is lowbrow, which is sometimes crude, or sometimes just like troglodyte internet stuff. But it is the resistance movement, and hence it's got support everywhere, but it can only be sort of manifested in either sort of a populist Führer way of the Sweden Democrats, or of like a guy in a pickup truck on the countryside or on the internet, which is, it's totally fascinating. And it's very much like Victorian Britain in that sense of having these very strong social taboos, but it's now mainly a cultural political thing more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting the class and status elements of this. You know, the way I have a little bit of a debate, I suppose, with those who take that more some kind of neo-Marxist approach that would say this is really about class and asserting power.
It's like class reductionism, essentially.
There's an argument. People.
Oh, sorry, you cut out for a moment. There's something with the microphone. I think it's. Yeah. Can you hear me? Or yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. I don't hear Eric.
If you take out the cord from the computer and put it back in.
Hey, can you hear me now?
Yes, now I can hear you.
Okay, all right.
just sit slightly closer to the computer so your audio.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, sorry, you were saying.
Right, remind me, what was the last question again? We were talking...
class and the class aspect. You were...
Yeah, the tendency to reduce is the class, neo-Marxists, who I presume are somehow your friends still, no?
Yes, they are.
I'm asking for a friend, so...
Yeah. So you have a bunch of... You have quite a few people like Rob Henderson or Michael Lind or Batya Sargon or a couple of others who would argue this is kind of like a new part of what it means to be part of the new upper class is to have this sensibility. My view is that you start with the ideas which become seen as the right ideas, and then those ideas, people herd in behind them. Mm-hmm. So it becomes prestigious to have the right ideas. And so in 1890, the right idea was temperance, restriction of alcohol, restriction of immigration. Those were the right ideas. Mm. By the time between 1890 and in the 1920s, there was a shift, and those ideas lost power in the elite. Mm. And they were I'm talking about the US case, and they were replaced by a set of other ideas. One of which was that you shouldn't ban alcohol. Another, gradually, after 1910s, was this idea, at least in kind of liberal Protestant circles, that immigration was a good thing and you shouldn't restrict it. And now, of course, there were other elite ideas like eugenics, which was also had quite a bit of prestige. So you had and the eugenicists were important for immigration restriction because you had the popular anti-Catholicism, which didn't have a lot of respectability in the elite. But then you had the kind of eugenic ideas. So race was seen as forward-looking. Hmm. Heredity was scientific and forward-looking. Religious bigotry was backward-looking. Hmm. So Catholic was not respectable, but race thinking was respectable. Mm-hmm. That was in the 1910s period. That was starting to be challenged, but only at the edges. So you have these kind of high cultural trends as well, like romantic nationalism. You read Rousseau and what he says, Polish children, they should only be taught by Polish teachers and people who are proud of Poland. And all of this is coming from what would be the extreme left of the time. So, so there are different high cultural trends, but when we move into the 20th century, the high cultural trends now are all modernist and liberal. They're all about the individual against the collective. They're anti-tradition. And then increasingly, they are more and more and more egalitarian, more after the 1960s, but to some degree, even before the 1960s. It's just that, again, the dial gets turned up on that. And now, of course, the egalitarianism, cultural equality, equality between identity groups, no race gaps, no gender gaps. I mean, that's kind of the dominant way of thinking. Mm. But in terms of class, I would say that this tends to follow rather than lead. So the self-interest, the desire to please your customers and clients and staff in your corporation, be a woke corporation, that's all sort of derivative, secondary, once these ideas have attained prestige within universities and within the intellectual sphere. So we kind of have to, I think, to explain... To my mind, the class stuff is less interesting. And also, I should say that, if you looked at the 2016 election, half of college-educated whites voted for Trump. Mm. The degree to which income hardly matters for populist voting, class barely matters. It matters a little bit. education matters more, but even education doesn't matter anywhere near as much as, I would say, psychological disposition. So you can be a very well-educated, very well-traveled, financially well-off person living in Stockholm, but if you're psychologically wired to prefer the present to be like the past, you see difference as disorder, you're going to be a Sweden Democrat. And now you may, whether you vote for the Sweden Democrats or not, is not clear. I think if you're a male, you are more likely to vote for the Sweden Democrats, even kind of person. I think if you looked at the voting for the Sweden Democrats, you would probably find a lot of university educated people in that mix as well. But it's just that the working class are more likely.
Okay, but is your point that it's the cultural issues or exposure to multiculturalism rather than economic detriments that is the defining factor here?
I would say that's a consensus now in the academic quantitative literature on survey data. There's very, very, very little evidence that your employment status or income class makes that much difference to who you're going to support, and your immigration attitudes in particular. The immigration attitudes are much more linked to psychological dispositions, your ideology, and that kind of thing.
So that's fascinating. And I think I saw a quote from you somewhere, the difference, I mean, you talked about the north of England and the difference between, because you have this narrative of populism, quote unquote, of people being, you know, from coal towns in the north, or old industrial centers of the north, and them being, you know, impoverished by globalization and hence voting for things like Brexit and against immigration, and London being this hotbed of you know, secular intellectual multiculturalism, and really what we should be thinking and talking about is basically the sort of an algorithm of both a sort of psychological character, but also more of a cultural outlook than sort of an economic status, which I find interesting because it's not the narrative to hear.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you were to take white working, white non-college, non-university, people without university education who are white, born in Britain, age 45, in London, you take that person and you take the exact same person, 45 years old, born in Britain, white, British, outside of London, anywhere, countryside, small town, north of England, there's essentially no difference in their likelihood of voting Brexit. So the only difference is that London has fewer, as a proportion, fewer people that don't have a degree, fewer people who are old, fewer white British people, and has more ethnic minorities, more college educated, and more young people. And that is the only reason London voted to remain. And by the way, it voted to remain 62-38. So 38% of London still voted to leave. And all of that is lost. And people think there's something about the cosmopolitan atmosphere of London. From what I can tell, that makes zero impact. Almost zero impact on the on people's choices. It's mainly down to these demographics fact. You know, it's just compositional. What are the types of people that live in one place versus another? Coastal towns, it's all old retirees that are all white. Yeah, they're going to vote, and very few of them have a degree. So you're going to have a different sort of pattern coming. And so it's true that the economically dynamic areas tend to be the multicultural areas because they attract the immigrants. And that is therefore an illusion. So the depressed areas tend to be more homogenous. And so it's an illusion. If you just look at poverty, you can say, oh, well, places that are struggling, left behind, they're the ones who are voting for Trump, for Leave, for maybe the Sweden Democrat. But actually, it's just an artifact of the types of people that live in these places. And so I don't put in very little stock in the economics.
Okay. So that's an explanation, but it's also very sort of negative for people who are positivist in the sense of there's a lot of still going around the free market types who are like, no, but there is no real problem here because the only thing is that we need more GDP growth and we need more, like if these people had X amount of money more in income, they would obviously see sort of this in a different light. And the problem is always people who are conservative, who are, you know, they're not as progressive in their outlook. And actually, like, this seems to not be as mutable as these people seem to believe, because there's a lot of people who sort of put stock in I mean, traditionally conservative values. And I don't say that as like a political term, but more as the psychological outlook of a person.
Yeah, I think that the economic explanation has very little behind it. And in fact, I'd even go as far as to say that when times are good, people worry less about the economy, and immigration has a chance to become a more important issue for elections. Mm-hmm. If you look at the post-2014 populist moment, this was after the 2007-08 financial crisis. You can take a natural experiment. 2007-08 financial crisis, 2015-16 migrant crisis. Which one led to a big jump in populist support? It's the 2015-16 crisis. 2007-08 had zero impact. And so, and I think that's, and in fact, I'd almost argue the reverse. Like when things started to get better, that's, you know, as we get into the later, you know, 2009, 10, 11, 12, people are worrying less about the unemployment and the economy. And then suddenly immigration is rising, terrorism is rising as a concern. And then once you get those issues rising up people's priority list, that's when you get populism. So that's why I would say if cost of living becomes less important, if Russia and Israel become less important, then I would predict we're going to have more populism, not less, because there will be more space, more oxygen for immigration as an issue, to integration as an issue, to rise up the political agenda. So actually, if anything, I think we're probably in a... So one, just give me one... Can I
go
just...
Ahead. Yeah, do it.
Hi, James. Yes. Yeah. I believe it or not, I'm actually in the middle of a podcast, but I will be done in about...
Well, it could work for if it doesn't.
Okay. You. Yes, I definitely want to... Yeah. Okay, take... Sorry about that.
That's actually great content. Okay. But to take Carl's point, that in a way, both neoliberals, neo-Marxists would, in that sense, have an too great emphasis on economics, because they think that would also, like... Okay, it's a problem, but we can also solve it. What we're discussing here is that not just things get better, they get worse when they get better, so to speak, in the terms of like polarized debate.
Yeah.
But another way of saying that is that it's then perfectly rational from someone who is a progressive to maintain high migration rates. And if you look into the kind of demographic patterns, that hasn't changed too greatly, irrespective of if it's been Labour or Tory in power. This, of course, your colleague Matt Goodwin has laid out in polls as well, or in stats, that these rates keep going up, so to speak. And without sounding too much like Peter Hitchens, that the Conservative Party is not conservative at all. But in a way, what I think is interesting with regards to previous conversation on Ireland and the backlashes we're seeing there with regards to migration, and also in the UK, where you sort of have a impetus for a reform party. It's interesting to see, in a way, like your take on what the political landscape will look like going forward if it is the case that if not demography, then culture is destiny.
Yes. I mean, what will the political landscape look like going forward? I mean, I think you're right, first of all, that both left and right have a strong pro-immigration streak. You know, the conservative parties, the business lobbies are very closely connected with the conservative parties, the business donors. The MPs tend to be drawn from university, where they were attracted to the right mainly for free market ideas. At least that used to be the case. Maybe that's changing as the mix of ideas that's coming through, say, alternative media and podcasts is a little more NatCon and a little less LibCon. Yeah. Maybe there will be a shift in that young generation. But at least through the 80s and the 90s, you look at a lot of the Tory MPs, they were attracted by Hayek and by Thatcher and the free market ideas. So you have the free market ideas plus the business lobbies and donors. They are setting the direction of the Conservative Party. And in Britain, they're a very important force in the Republican Party in the United States, in any conservative parties. And on the left, you've got the sort of what I would call the cultural socialists or the left modernists. And so they're dominant there, too. They're both pro-immigration. It's interesting, you know, in New Zealand, where they... Ardern promised to reduce immigration from 80,000 to 40,000. Mm. She was on the left and was being resisted by the right party, who were not making that promise. Canada, where they've got a ridiculous level of immigration under Trudeau, the so-called populist conservative party leader. Yes, he's good on some things, but he's not. He has refused to challenge Trudeau on the numbers question. Mm. So I think this shows where, in both cases, it's partly about being politically correct and abiding by a taboo, but also it's about business lobby. And so, yeah, how do you then, you know, I don't see any way out of this other than a populist party threatening. So right now, the Reform Party in Britain is broke. They've broken 10%. They're now costing the Conservatives Party. Already, the Tories are way well down in the polls. But the debate is going to be, well, did the Tories lose because they moved too far right and therefore their voters switched to the Labour Party, or they moved too far left and therefore their Labour switched to the Reform Party? But the fact the Reform Party is there is very important. UKIP did the same thing. UKIP under Nigel Farage forced the Conservative Party to the right on immigration in Europe. Now, of course, it then betrayed, it did Brexit, but it betrayed on immigration. And so now the question is going to be, what is the fallout going to be? So the dynamic I see is that the populist, the challenge must come first from the populist right. That then forces the center right into a rethink and makes it say, or perhaps the center left, like in Denmark, into a rethink, and then they adapt as a result of this challenge. I think that's the only real way to make progress. And it doesn't matter if that's in a first past the post system like Britain or the US, or whether it's in a proportional representation system as in Europe. Mm.
Maybe you can help me out on this, because I'm constantly having a struggle of thinking, what's the most important driving force here, in the sense of, we've talked about these taboos, we've talked about sort of how they were created, but they're perpetuated by a system. I mean, a person like Curtis Yarvin would call it the cathedral, but you could call it academic institutions. You could call it, you know, the end product of the long march through the institutions, who believe that these taboos are not only necessary, but basically just a start for launching sort of a further progressive project. And we see, I think, in a country like Sweden, who now has a ostensibly right, conservative, liberal government, it's very hard to get things done, because you have institutional resistance from the all the lobby groups, all the academics. In a country where you cannot produce, I mean, for instance, statistics on things like crime, et cetera, because well, it's been taboo to do so. It's very hard to formulate policy, and it's hard to also, you could see this in Trump's case. I think it's the seminal one where he sort of wins the sort of battle, but loses the war, in the sense that he does not have any institutional support at all. And this is, I think, what sort of conservative politicians around the West are afraid of, because they go into power to try to do things, but then they get this heavy resistance from Johan would probably call it the deep state. I think that's
the blob. Yeah, yeah, the blob.
The blob.
We call it the blob.
The blob is great. It's a great term.
The blob is a good term.
But what I would say is, this is kind of, I think, going to be the next big challenge for the NatCon populist right, is to say, well, how are we going to break the power of the cathedral? Now, I'm more optimistic than some. I think that we haven't even begun. We haven't even begun. If you look at, for example, let's take a case of success. The American Supreme Court, which, you know, this used to be run by liberals. And then there was a conservative legal movement with the Federalist Society at the helm. And what the Federalist Society does is it vets candidates, scores candidates so that they can be placed at different levels of the U.S. court system by incoming Republican administrations. And they've managed to shift the composition of the Supreme Court that way. And so what that is saying is, we know that all institutions drift left. So we're going to consciously resist that by politicizing these institutions and placing people with our values in those institutions, because we do not trust the established members of this institution to reproduce the institution in a fair and balanced way. Mm. And I'm afraid we're going to have to increasingly recognize that that is reality. So this means a withdrawal of trust from institutions. It also means a centralization of, at least in theory, the possibility to centralize power away from these institutions. Mm. And so, I mean, I don't, clearly, with a court, you have to, you know, it's protecting rights. That's very important. But you can at least politicize selection. The next stage is, I think, the politicization of the bureaucracy and the civil service. And that's starting, I think, to happen. Again, the U.S. is probably out front on this. So the Heritage Foundation has now been developing with about 75 organizations this database of tens of thousands of potential appointees for the U.S. government. And when they were unprepared last time, but this time around, what they're going to do is essentially try and essentially almost invade the federal government with these appointees. In order to do that, you have to set the legal landscape so that you have to be able to fire people. You need to change the laws first to allow you to fire people, to allow you to shut down certain bureaus and agencies and create new agencies. There is a whole kind of battle plan there that needs more thought. I think it's doable. It's going to be a kind of revolution where you are in making political appointments. So this idea of a neutral, non-political institution, I think that's been proven false because of infiltration and corruption, pretty well naked ideological corruption, even though it goes under the euphemism of just being nice and tolerant and whatever. It's not. It's actually importing very radical ideas and political biases. So what's going to be needed is very hands-on reform of all of these institutions, enforcing political neutrality, including you all public buildings. We're not going to do any flags other than the national municipal flag. So no pride, no Black Lives Matter, no special this day, that day. All of that can be removed. You can enforce political neutrality and non-discrimination in hiring. So remove all of the politics out of any public funded institution, including schools. I think you can do it. All of this is starting to happen. Ron DeSantis is probably the leader in the U.S. case. I think that is going to be the next phase of trying out these tools to see what can be done to change the character of the blob or the deep state. I think that hasn't been tried. I think it's been all talk. The right has essentially given in. If you look since Reagan, for example, Reagan tried to roll back affirmative action, tried to change the teaching of history in the U.S. Those battles were won by the other side. The other side had the stamina. Whereas all of the right-wing lobbies, guns, abortion, those are the things the right-wing lobbies paid attention to between elections. We're actually going to need lobbies that pay attention to issues like immigration, like wokeness in the civil service and political bias in the civil. We're going to need lobbies that score MPs on how well they're doing on that, get them to sign pledges. All of that stuff is going to have to happen in between elections in order to hold their feet to the fire on these sort of more NatCon type issues, because it's not enough just to have an election every 4 years.
I mean, to give Reagan his due, he did get rid of the solar panels on the White House.
All right.
but I think this is where we should actually pivot to your own work now, Eric, with regards to the Heterodox Social Sciences Center that you're building up. Like, because what you describe now in a way or laid out is a numbers game where evidently there's fewer conservatives within higher education, and several of them are either being pushed out or leaving themselves. So I wonder, with regards to everything you just detailed, which is essentially or ostensibly a sort of warlike situation with regards to the regime of government as of the moment, and regime here in including, of course, not just specific party, body politics as in like body in a very state-like way. But what are the mechanisms that you see going forward, both regards to your own work and how that can be scaled up? And in a way now, we are moving to a close, but I think it touches on how you end Taboo, the book that's coming out next year, on what are the antidotes, the actual remedies that one could put forward or commit yourself to.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's really two approaches. I mean, one is setting up new institutions, and I'm involved in doing that with the Center for Heterodox Social Science, where we're going to do alternative social science. And so I've got a course on woke, for example, which is 15 weeks open to the public. I'm launching that in January. And if you go to my Twitter, you can see on the pinned tweet that's available. Now, that would be one example. So you can do that. But I think there are only certain fields where this is possible. Media is probably the most open to new entrants. The barriers to entry, as long as they don't censor and demonetize and do all the other tricks that some of the other social media platforms do, it's a more wide open field, and you can get existing legacy media challenged a little bit more, perhaps less so on the television media side and more so in the print side. However, it's much more difficult at universities. You know, I'm at the own Buckingham, which is the only university out of 181 where free speech is tops and social justice is you know, subservient. It's, although there's still, you will see pride flags, you will see other things around the campus. It's still largely, probably leans progressive in any case. But it's the only institution. University is very difficult because you have alumni, you have reputations. Those rankings change very little. It's very hard to set up new institutions. I know the University of Austin has set up, but it's very difficult to challenge the hierarchy. And so in many cases, you can't create a new civil service. Now, you cannot. So what I would say is I think that the biggest thing that needs to happen is not so much. Yes, we need to try to do an alternative media. I think it's harder in movies, perhaps, although I know Daily Wire is trying to challenge it. But I think taking over the existing legacy institutions or reforming or challenging them is very important. So I think actually the biggest part of what we need to do is to try and reform the blob, to try and reform public institutions. And I think a good analogy for this is if you compare what Elon Musk has done with Twitter, now X, to what Gab and Parler and some of these newer sites, free speech sites, were able to do, Rumble and so on, I think there's no question that Elon Musk's takeover of an existing kind of legacy, if you like, institution has had a much bigger impact. And likewise, I would expect, for example, that reforming public schools, preventing them from teaching critical race and gender ideology and indoctrinating, is going to be a lot more important than allowing school choice and new schools to be set up. Because I don't believe those, even if you have school choice, most of the people are going to choose based on criteria that do not threaten progressive orthodoxy. So just get my kid into the top university, get them ahead. That's all that I care about. And so even with a private system, some of the worst offenders on the woke stuff are in the private system. So I don't believe in school choice, setting up new institutions as an alternative. I think you should do it. It's going to have an impact in media, but its impact in the institutional space is going to be a lot more limited. So I'm an interventionist. I don't believe. Now, I am a procedural liberal. I believe in the rights of the citizen, for example, and I don't think government should be intruding into the rights of the citizenry. But I do think that, for example, governments intruding into the autonomy of public institutions like universities and schools is perfectly legitimate in a democratic system. I don't believe institutional autonomy is as necessary for liberalism. I think that institutions must earn their right to be autonomous, to earn the trust of the population. If they break trust by becoming ideological, then they should lose that autonomy. And so that is essentially, I actually see a centralization of power into elected government, which the people have a say in. They have no say in these institutions. I think elective government needs to penetrate and reform these institutions to remove the political coloring of these institutions. I think that's perfectly legitimate. And you know, to some extent, that's the principle of the U.S. Supreme Court. We don't trust this institution to be neutral. And so we are going to have to politically contest it. I think we've just got to expand that philosophy to a wider set of public institutions.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because I think, especially in this country, we've been doing a lot of so-called reforms under their banner of sort of democratization. And it's always been towards the left side of the spectrum. It's always meant, under the cover of night, let's make this a more leftist institution by making it adhere to certain rules. And I think that this is a great point, because I think in a country like Sweden, like Canada, and like the UK, who has, for instance, state media, which is very powerful, this is a must. And I think the sort of libertarian view that has come out of the right for the last 30 years has been inadequate to the task and really needs to be done away with.
Yeah. I mean, you can see, for example, and I think like right now, okay, even though I am in favor of abolishing the Canadian Broadcasting, of funding, government funding for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which is the position of the conservative, I think his approach in Canada is really, well, if we, you know, this is really an economic issue. Yeah. And if their services are valued by the public, then they'll be able to generate revenue. My view is the problem with that is The CBC will then be privatized and will become, well, it's already as woke as it can possibly be, but I don't think that's enough. I think you actually, it would be almost better to keep the CBC within public control and ruthlessly enforce political neutrality. So the BBC has some pressure in Britain to be politically neutral, but the people who oversee it from the Conservative Party have gone native. They don't want to ruffle feathers. Yeah. That's the problem. You need somebody who is going to fire people, who's going to leak to the media, who's going to take a much more adversarial position and say, no, we're going to track you using big data, and you are going to, and then we've now got big data. We can track very closely. You're going to be neutral down the line. And I think we can do that. We have to get our hands in dealing with content, school lessons, school history, what is being taught, interfere with that, not just say, oh, well, we'll have private schools where they can teach classics and do non-woke stuff. This, to my mind, that sort of free market solution is not going to work. It's only going to work at the edges. It's great if you're a super well-informed parent, but for most of the kids, they're still going to be indoctrinated, and you're still going to have the problem of, you know, two-thirds of young people who think James Damore should have been fired by Google. So yeah, I think we are going to have to get into the weeds of all of these cultural questions and really start to reform institutions in what is quite a heavy-handed way, a sort of centralized way. It's still democratic and it's still, you know, it's respecting people's individual rights. And it's not going against the law, but it is saying we don't trust the institutions to be neutral.
We waited with one quite fundamental question till the end because we're coming to a close now. Yeah. But essentially, I think me and Carl have been also curious as to ask sort of what made you snap or how did you change your mind? Because in a way, the way you reason around these things is very much from the outlook of a reformer, or maybe we should say a reforminator. but I would say like that puts you already in a minority with regards to how academics even view their own work and deed. As of the moment, more thinking of a sort of status quo preserver and might think of themselves as doing that for some sort of universal notion of justice. But we ask this question also in part because these are the kind of questions that people like yourself who want to change the system but receive pushback. Like, okay, so why are you doing this? What happened to you? And of course, we could retort back, well, what happened to academia? What happened to our liberal colleagues or progressive colleagues? But do you see what we're trying to grasp here?
And you know, I'm never somebody who was a progressive and became a conservative. You know, I don't think my views have changed much since about age 10. I mean, so I think however I was formed psychologically or environmentally, maybe it was growing up abroad, right? I think that's no doubt a big part of the picture. You know, I've always felt like an alien in these institutional settings. And this is going back to the late 1980s and early 90s when it was all about political correctness and multiculturalism. You know, those are things I instinctively disliked from the start and thought were strange from the start. You know, and I can't really explain why, but for whatever reason, that was never part of something I could see the logic of. And maybe I always like to understand what I'm buying before I buy it. Whereas maybe more people will just kind of go along with it, or maybe it was something I was more interested in. I've always been interested in culture. And so therefore I took these things more seriously, whereas other people, they might've just, you know, it would have just washed over because they're mainly interested in
paying mortgages,
cars or the economy or yeah. So, you know, getting money or whatever. So I think that's maybe those are some of the reasons. I never went through a Marxist phase. You know, a lot of right-wing intellectuals did go through these kind of Marxist phases. Like I can't claim, like David Goodhart, I can't claim to have done that. So, you know, I mean, I don't think my views have actually changed all that much over. I've been always somewhat of a national populist type conservative. Never, I mean, I was to some degree a bit more attracted to free market ideas in the past. It's not that I reject those ideas, but I sort of understand the problem with too much economic dislocation. And, you know, I still haven't reconciled myself to unions, but I understand that you need to be able to protect workers. It might be through helping, you know, through the welfare state, which I've always supported. So I don't know. But I don't think my outlook has really changed a lot. It's more that things have kind of changed around me, you know. So even this thing about wokeness. Yeah, I was you know, already to some degree, I won't say getting in trouble, but ruffling feathers in the early 1990s on some of these questions. So it's not as though I just think that we're living through a period which is not really that different from 30 years ago, in at least in the intellectual level. It's just that there's been a perhaps a deeper penetration and intensification of these ideas in institutions.
Yes. As we started out with, me and Carl, this is part of some kind of change also when we tried to start working also with private actors in changing the outlook of the corporate leadership.
That's exciting because, yeah, the private sector side of this, I tend to think that they follow trends, you know, but I also think there may be some role for certain kinds of government regulation around, especially if there's cartel-like behavior around having to have the right values in order to have access to markets. And I think there are perhaps places where you could have political neutrality enforced from a regulatory regime as well.
I think also, me and UNC, I think we tried to run, and UN is involved in this in Sweden a lot, and running events for people in who are sort of heterodox thinkers in the private sector and who have the sort of mindset that I think you have, and I think we share to a degree as well, of being, you know, in opposition to the current sort of trends. And I think mobilizing them and sort of also giving them sort of information and a bit of hope is really a thing that's not done, because I think a lot of left sort of types go into academia and become the sort of experts, and there are a lot of people sitting with sort of clenched fists in the private sector and thinking, just what am I paying taxes for? But these people need to be, you know, mobilized in a sort of intellectual sense, not only to be, you know, economical conservatives, which they sort of naturally are in many cases, but also taking an interest in what's really happening in government policy and the broader culture.
But it's also playing the numbers game, that if you want to build this alternative administrators, essentially, you need to go into some sphere that is relatively healthy, which the private sphere is, in terms of having to be competitive at some level. Mm-hmm. And the general populace in this regard is not woke, but it rather like the administrators, the manager class is the one that's the problem here.
Right.
So if you want, so by working with people whose main mindset is production as opposed to control, then if you can develop the intellectual non-binarism among them, then you have like then you have,
careful with that term non-binary.
But like then you have an alternative elite to supplant the previous one with. We're trying to build some kind of a class coalition in that regard,
or trying to, starting with the university chapters, you know, and getting people a pipeline of talent, you know, all of those sorts of things which the left is so good at.
Yes.
Is probably something that we're going to have to do.
Yeah.
Okay, that will have to be the concluding comment then.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, Johan. Thanks, Carl. Thanks very much, you guys. All the best.
Yes, take care.
Okay, take care.